intergalactic planetary, intergalactic. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Jane Lamb Carroll is kind enough to join us, a professor of history and women's studies at St. Catherine University, a contributing author and co-editor of Liberating Sanctuary, 100 Years of Women's Education at the College of St. Catherine. She has a book out, Daybreak Woman, An Anglo-Dakota Life. She's kind enough today to talk to us about an amazing life and an amazing story. Jane, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, I got to ask you, because I've interviewed a lot of people who will bring up a character from history I've never heard of. How exactly did you come across the woman Jane Anderson Robertson and her story?
Well, I had been doing research for some time in looking at relationships between Dakota and Euro-Dakota women and Anglo-American men in early Minnesota, early 19th century. And her name and her family's names kept popping up in that research, and it got to the point where I realized that there was probably enough material for me to put together a biography. Mm. And so I did.
When you started looking independently for, you know, her history, were you surprised at how much was out there?
I was, as the project went along, I was surprised, especially for the later part of her life. I was actually very lucky to come upon a motherload of correspondence. She herself left very few letters, or very few of her letters were preserved, I should say, and she did not leave an account herself. Mm-hmm. But as I really dug into the archives and the various sources, I was pleasantly surprised that I was able to find more, especially, as I said, in the later part of her life, about what was going on with her family and what was going on with her in those last decades especially. But the whole project was challenging, and I talk about this in the introduction of my book. Any project on women's history, especially a woman who was not famous, is very challenging because, you know, women tended to leave few records, even if they were literate, and she was literate in two languages, both Dakota and English. But so what you do is you have to look at the sources created and preserved that were created by men and preserved, and then in all kinds of, you know, government records. And so you're finding little scraps or pieces of things and putting it all together like a puzzle, which is challenging and really interesting, but also can be frustrating.
And let's not mix past the point that there's a lot of people that try to bury history, especially history they don't want people to know about. I interviewed William Green about the book Nellie Francis, and, you know, there's another character in history where, you know, there seemed to almost be a concerted effort to keep her history from being told. You know, if you have people that are not, you know, on, you know, realizing the impact the individual had, there's a tendency for sometimes for that to get dismissed. I imagine that didn't help things either.
Yes. So one of the projects of this book for me was to, you know, women have been silenced, as have Dakota and Euro-Dakota people in the master narrative of this region's history. And so that was really, those are the fundamental aims of the book, really, is to put Dakota people and women at the center of this history of this region. Mm-hmm. And yes, and in fact, I address that in my introduction. I talk about the fact that some people will question why a biography of this particular woman, because she was not, you know, she was not a pioneer or a first in terms of her accomplishments. She was not famous at all. And in fact, the point I make is that, you know, most people are not famous. Mm-hmm. If you really want to understand what the past was like and the nature of people's lives, we have to look at all people and all their diversity, mm-hmm. and especially people who have been ignored, marginalized, or stereotyped as Dakota and Euro-Dakota people have, as, you know, women have. So
I think what you capture, too, is and I'm glad that Minnesota, at least some elements of Minnesota, are starting to go back and look at the Native American history post-settlers and realize what an amazing history it was, because she, you know, as though her life did get tragic and there were some hardships that definitely came down the line, when she was born in a fairly vibrant, socially diverse, culturally diverse community that was, it seemed actually to be working fairly well.
Yes. And so that's what's fascinating about this period for me and this multicultural history. And of course, that's all been kind of forgotten or dismissed by the dominant master narrative of the region. But yes, it was very vibrant, very diverse in terms of cultures and nationalities and coming together. And it existed for many generations, before the mid-19th century. So, yes, it's fascinating. It's a history that I really want everyone to learn about, because it's a history that most people are not familiar with.
She was born 1810, the Minnesota River. For the most part, it was Native Americans and just fur traders, correct, at that point?
Right, exactly. There's not, up until the mid-1850s, the dominant population in Minnesota would have been indigenous people and Euro-indigenous people. They were the vast majority of the population, and there were very few Euro-Americans or whites, and those that who were in the region at that time would have been fur traders.
She grows up in this society, and we know things start to turn as more and more European settlers come on in. But, I mean, it sounds like we're able to piece together, she grew up in a fairly, accepting. I don't know if that's the right term, but, I mean, it was a culture that I think was understanding that things were changing, but still had a positive vibe, if that's the right word, to it, that there was still the culture of the indigenous people was still there with this slight bit of adding that was coming on. Is that a way to say it, I guess?
Yes. So this is one of the main points that I try to make in her biography, that she was, both indigenous and Euro-indigenous people were the majority, and that their cultures were very strong. And if she was able, as a Euro-Indigenous person, to live in both cultures, to embody both and to live her life, and that was accepted because they were the majority mm-hmm. of people. But then everything, that all changes when Euro-Americans become the majority of the population. She, like most people in that time, like most Euro-Indigenous people, was bilingual. And in her case, she was also biliterate, both in Dakota and English. She may have also understood or spoken a little bit of French, because French was actually the dominant language of the trade. So it was only after, in the late 18th century that the British really take over the fur trade, and then you get more English people or British people coming in. But French remains really dominant, and Dakota as well. So yes, she's able to live her life as a bicultural or Euro-Indigenous person, as are other people like her, if they choose to do that. But then that all changes dramatically when she's in her middle age.
I find that interesting. When you go into a it's a person that goes into a foreign country realizing they're the outsider and realizing they need to learn versus what then came. And as we get later into her life here in the 1850s, 1860s, I mean, Minnesota and the U.S. government they double cross the Native Americans, steal the land, and keep pushing the Native Americans further and further west. Talk a little bit about, before the Dakota War of 1862. I mean, a lot of Native Americans, indigenous people, were seeing that where this was going, that this was this, the white European settlers were not going to stop until they were driven completely out.
Yes, well, the turning point for the Dakota, of course, were the treaties of 1851, because those treaties opened up or took the Dakota homeland, basically all of it west of the Mississippi. They had agreed to a treaty in 1837 that took their land east of the Mississippi. These treaties of 1851, which were, enacted coercively and were fraudulent in a number of ways that I talk about in the book. But those were, that's really the turning point, because at that point, then there, the vast majority of their land is taken away. They are forced to go settle on the Minnesota River reservations. And initially, they're given two reservations, and then in 1858, there's another treaty in which they're pressured into giving up basically half of that. So now they've been reduced to a very, very small area of land, and it's impossible to live as they always had, which was to live communally by hunting, gathering, growing. Limited agriculture. They can't continue to live their traditional lifestyle. So it's not only about taking the land. They can't survive economically, but the culture is all wrapped up in that traditional lifestyle, and they can no longer survive that way.
I like how you label the Dakota and Euro Dakota, because I think there is just too much tendency. I think we have to make sure, and as we talk about the indigenous people of the area, the reality is that you might have had some European heritage, but if you had Native American heritage, indigenous heritage as well, that didn't matter. You were basically pushed out with the rest of them. That was the harshness. I mean, it was the being pushed out and being relocated again. There's a tendency of us to just downplay the insane. I mean, I've seen the pictures at Fort Snelling. You hear the stories, and of course, on the larger scale, the Trail of Tears that happened earlier in this country's history. The displacement of large swaths of indigenous people. I mean, that the tragedy, the sadness, that imagine that was something that it's touched on a lot here, and that the fact that this was trying to keep a heritage alive, as clearly this European influence was trying to wipe it out.
Yes, and you're talking about really genocidal policies.
Yeah.
Where they're forced out of the state completely. And, in addition to being, you have the executions of the warriors for being involved in the war, but then everyone else is either put in prison or forced out of the state and then taken to a place, where they literally cannot survive, right? Mm-hmm. So, but what one of the reasons I wanted to focus on a Euro-Dakota person is because they are also kind of lost in the history, right?
Mm-hmm.
What interests me as a historian is the complexity of our past, especially cultural complexity. And so these people, there were many, many people over many generations. And you're right, what happens as a result of Euro-American colonization, and then especially after the war, is that in the eyes of whites, a Euro-Dakota person is a Dakota. So they have, many of them suffered, of course, along with their Dakota kin. There was also, however, as I point out in the book, a whole range of things that happened. So not all Dakota people were exiled. There was a very small group that weren't. Not all Euro-Dakota people were exiled, and Daybreak Woman was one of those people who was lucky, although her relatives, some of her relatives, of course, were. And the other thing I wanted to make a point of here is, when we do read about Dakota or Euro-Dakota people, for that fact, it's always, almost always, in relation just to the war. And then we hear,
yes,
they're exiled. But then, the assumption seems to be that they disappear.
Yeah, you're exactly right, yeah.
And in fact, very early on, many of them start coming back into Minnesota Mokoche and reestablishing themselves. And those communities become the nucleus of the Dakota communities that are here in the state today. And the other point I make in the book is, again, some of them didn't leave. And many Euro-Dakota people did not leave. And so their experiences and their responses varied. And as in the case of Daybreak Woman and her family, they did not leave. Not all of them. Her immediate family didn't leave, although her sister, of course, was exiled to Crow Creek and, mm-hmm. and died there. But, I think it's really fascinating to remember, to look at, what happens afterwards, mm-hmm. right? What happens afterwards? How do they rebuild their lives? How do people come back? How do they rebuild their communities in exile? And then eventually, how do some of them come back and rebuild here in Minnesota?
And you bring up that last point you made about the fact that we forget about the history of the Dakota afterwards. And then when you talk about indigenous women, how the history of them has been so wiped off the planet, that it's only now we have leaders in the state, Peggy Flanagan, Mary Kanish Pudin, who are putting forward this Indigenous Women's Bill. It's for goodness sakes, we shouldn't just have Native American women disappearing. And it's part of that is that when you have a culture that overnight dominates and overrides another culture and definitively wants to erase the history, not only do you erase a lot of the overall history, but then you get a point where there's these massive gaps I think people just don't pay attention to, that realize that there were a lot of people that were doing everything in their power to save the culture as it was, because they could see if they didn't do it, no one else was going to.
Yes, and women were absolutely vital to that. They were central to that, to preserving the culture and handing it down. Daybreak Woman's robust Dakota identity is really is a matrilineal inheritance from her mother and her grandmother. And that is the role of Dakota women. They're central to the culture and to preserving the culture and to the history. And the fact that she herself, what was really interesting about her compared to other women I had studied, other Euro-Dakota women, was that she had a very unusual upbringing in that she lived with her mother for about 12 years, and then she went and lived with her father up in Canada for about 14 or 15 years. And as a young adult woman, she really had a choice about, she could have stayed up in Canada and she had been educated and she could have lived as an Anglo-American woman, which is how she was living pretty much with her father's family. But she chose to come back, as she wanted to. Her Dakota identity was so robust, and she wanted to come back and associate herself again with her family and her kin and the Dakota people and come back to Minnesota Mokoche. So that really struck me as important. And I think that's a matrilineal inheritance.
Daybreak Woman and Anglo-Dakota Life, Jane Lamb Carroll. Congratulations on the book. I hope it gets a lot of press, because I think that it's wonderful that we are now revisiting these stories that should have been remembered, but now at least we have people championing them. Congratulations on this. Thank you very much for the time today.
Thank you, Matt.
Let's take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.